Good evening. I'm K2, Romeo, India Whiskey. And with the help of Mel, K2KEY, Kilo Echo Yankee, we run a thing called the TechNet. And the major purpose of the TechNet is education. The amateurs gather at this time and teach each other how to get better enjoyment out of this hobby, how to make things work better, how do things work. We quite often discuss antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers and propagation and satellites and moon bounce and meteor scatter. It goes on and on. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. And we try to discuss quite a few of those from time to time. Once in a while, Mel and Dick will plan a particular subject that we discuss on the TechNet, but for the most part, 90-some-odd% of the time, the subjects that they discussed on the TechNet are the subjects that you guys bring as questions or comments. So it's your show. You can decide what we're going to discuss. Almost any subject of interest to amateur radio operators, usually electronics. Sometimes you get into high-definition television and cell phones and things that are related, software-defined radios, computer tie-ins with radios. It's all related. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes. And the word yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins tonight? I hope we do. Please give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW.
Two and then you. No.
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
Studio T-Mobile. No question. Howard here.
In 2EO, no question. Is it...
November 2, Charlie Tango Mike. No question or comment.
WS2N, Paul, with no questions.
Okay. In some random order here, Alex... N2NNU with a no so far, but maybe we'll coax him into having a question. Rich, N2EO with no question. KC2MDP, Steve. Thank goodness we got somebody with a real question. He gave us a yes. Howard with a no. Paul with a no. And Mr. CTM, I think it was, with a no. Have I missed anyone so far? K2RIW listening.
Chicken, WW2W.
Okay, WWT.
K2KEY.
Mel recognized. And Tony, your signal was extremely noisy tonight. And I think you said you had no question. But when we get around to you, if you've got a question, anything you can do to aim a little more signal toward the repeater would help. Or, let's see now, has anyone tested whether or not the Eastern input is operational? Let me give a quick test on that one.
Morgan Prime, Dick.
Glad to hear that.
You might want to actually ask people out there in IRLP land if they want to check in, give them a little space. Seems like we have Nevada hooked up and probably Ben down in North Carolina.
Very fine, Eric. That was Eric, KE2EJ. Okay, we're going to give a nice long delay right now so that those who want to check in by way of the internet have an opportunity to do so. Give us your call letters and name and the yes or no at this time. K2RIW, my name is Dick. Nice long delay.
W2RIY, Joe.
Yes. Okay, Joe recognized. And one last call with a nice long delay. Anyone else by way of the internet at this time? And a few minutes downrange, maybe a half hour downrange, we'll do this again. And somebody may have to remind me, because I know we do get kind of fast on the key here for the people who sign in. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name and that yes or no at this time. K2RIW here, just doing a test on the Eastern input. Looks like it's working very well. I'm back on the Western input. Okay, the first person with a real question was Steve, KC2MDP. What's happening in your neighborhood, Steve?
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to everyone else on the net. Dick, you know, all this talk about high-def TV and everything else, you know, and got me to thinking that how come you don't see any more TVs, you know, or computers for that matter, with, you know, the old picture tube? You know, everything today is LCD, it seems. Is there a reason for this? Your opinions on that. And as far as the old-fashioned picture tubes compared to the, you know, the LCD monitors, what's your opinions on as far as, you know, which is going to last longer and which has got a better quality? You know, my computer, I have the LCD monitor, and I also have the old CRT tube. And it seems like the CRT tube, you know, got a better picture. You know, I mean, we won't say it's a lot better, but it's a lot clearer and stuff. Just your opinions on this. Back to you, Dick.
Getting a nice long delay. I've got lots of opinions on that. The expert on the subject is Eric. After I give my my 2 cents worth, if Eric would like to give us his 2 cents worth from the broadcaster's point of view, advantage of cathode ray tubes, the old technology versus the newer technologies, TFTs, LCDs, plasma screens, and whatever, the flat screens. My understanding, Steve, is that if your definition of a good picture is the highest possible resolution, dots per inch you could call it, the highest possible on-to-off ratio, in other words, dark versus bright screen, the highest possible purity of chrominance, in other words, the purity of the colors, it is my belief that cathode ray tubes stand head and shoulders is a little bit strong, but at least a head above almost everything else. That's the good news about cathode ray tubes. Cathode ray tubes are tremendously more heavy, voluminous, and expensive. To my knowledge, there is no longer any manufacturer left in the United States making cathode ray tubes. There are very few manufacturers worldwide making cathode ray tubes. As I said, they're expensive, they take up a lot of room, they require high voltages, and they are a little bit dangerous. You have to put some pretty fancy shields, safety shields around them, because if one of those high vacuum, very large volume cathode ray tubes ever imploded, and those glass shards come flying out of there, and wasn't a rather sturdy piece of transparent material between you and it, it could do you a lot of damage. So cathode ray tubes are becoming passe. It's sad, but that's the truth. These solid-state screens can be made extremely large. A cathode ray tube beyond approximately 35 inches is really pushing the edge of the art. The tremendous amount of... Let me drop. The tremendous amount of stored energy in that vacuum. I mean... Normally, Steve, you and I think of stored energy as a whole lot of compressed air inside of a tank. In the case of a cathode ray tube, you get the exact opposite. There's no high pressure in there. There's no pressure. Well, anything that differs a whole lot from Mother Nature is a form of stored energy. Nothing, which is what's inside that tube, is stored energy, because at 14 pounds per square inch, you've got a tremendous amount. You've got thousands of pounds of pressure on the outside trying to force its way in, and if that glass ever shatters, and all of that force on the outside starts moving that glass at not quite the speed of sound, but it's going to move those chunks of glass very fast. I was in the television repair business way back in the late 50s. I remember one particular customer I had in Middle Island, very close to Otis Lake, where he wanted his cathode ray tube replaced. I gave him a rebuilt tube at a very nice price. Installed it in his set. Set was a black and white set. This was way back in the late 50s. Color hadn't really caught on yet. Set worked beautifully after my repair and the reinstallation of the set back into his house. A day later, he called me up and said, "Wow, you got to see this." I came over to his house, and there was a whole bunch of glass embedded in the wall behind the television set. The safety glass up front had protected him. The rebuilt tube had some kind of a stress fracture in it. It imploded, Every one of the small tubes in the set that wasn't protected by a metal shield was shattered. The back of the set, the fiber board had been blown out, and a bunch of glass shards were embedded into his wall. That gave me a shudder to realize that without wearing safety glasses, because I was 18 years old at the time, I was invulnerable, I was invincible, and never realized that when I'm handing that bare picture tube in my hands and installing it in that set, that if at that period of time it decided to implode, it could very easily have damaged my face, my eyes, whatever. So they're dangerous. The cathode ray, the solid state flat screens now are very handy. I'm going to drop one more time. They can easily be made at great big sizes, like 60 inches, beyond 35 inches, cathode ray tubes. The amount of stored energy that's going up there by square law or cube law, as you make it bigger, the focusing becomes a lot more difficult, the high voltages required, the x-rays, the vulnerability to local magnetic fields. There's a bunch of disadvantages with cathode ray tubes. So thank goodness the solid state, the flat screen techniques are getting better all the time. They will eventually, in my opinion, approach the resolution and quality and on-off ratio and whatever that we used to get with cathode ray tubes. But for the time being, they are less expensive, easier to manufacture, larger if you like, and take up a heck of a lot less room and weigh a lot less. So they're going to be popular. Eric, I hope you've got some words you can add to all of this and correct some of the errors that I probably made. KE2EJ, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Do you have a comment? Cool.
Alex, right after Eric. Go ahead, Eric.
KQRIW, K2J. Yeah, well, there actually are a couple places that will rebuild your tubes left in the United States. The Chinese are currently being bad and producing a lot of tubes. They're still making small black and white with digital tuners in them. Things of that nature. Of course, most people don't realize that if you ever look at the front of the tube, it has this really, really thick-looking piece of glass. And it really serves two purposes. One of the reasons why we don't use CRTs is because of the lead in the glass. We put the lead in that big, fat piece of glass to stop the x-rays from coming out at you. And then, of course, there is a glue, which is an optical glue, and another piece of glass, and that's the safety glass. So that way, if the tube blows up behind it, it doesn't blow up at you sitting in front of it. It blows up from the back. By the way, LCDs are not yet really cheaper. They're on a par with the cost of a CRT these days. Or rather, when it was in large production. Now, of course, CRTs are far more expensive. The liquid crystal and plasma technology don't, if you put it up against a CRT, the CRT wins. Let me drop. There are two new flat screen technologies coming around the corner. It will be quite expensive to begin with, but will rival the colorimetry of a CRT. It's called an FED, and another one is an SED. They're two different animals, but they produce the same wavelength of light that the CRTs do. And actually, it duplicates it very well. So, that's what I've added. Dick, KQRIW.
And as you guys know, Eric is a significant engineer at two local public broadcasting system, broadcasting stations. So, he sees it firsthand by way of the National Association of Broadcasters, consumer electronic shows, and so on. Also, when you're standing in front of a cathode ray tube, you are literally in front of a gun. The neck of the tube is a so-called gun assembly, firing electrons at that phosphor that gives you the light on the front face. And so those electrons are being aimed right at you when you stand in front of the set. That's part of the reason that Eric mentioned all of the lead that's in that very thick piece of glass up front. Those 30,000 volt electrons aimed at you could be a little bit uncomfortable. There used to be people complaining about the x-rays coming out of the high voltage cage of large color television sets, creating health hazards to people who were doing television maintenance. Whether or not it's real or not, I don't know. So it sure looks like from
1B3s.
Yeah, the 1B3s, I guess you're saying that they were also making X-rays, the high-voltage rectifier.
Yeah, that was the culprit. It was the high-voltage rectifier that were actually making the X-rays, not the tubes themselves. They actually never were able to measure in those sets that they complained about from the tube, but came out of the rectifier.
K3 was the bad one.
Yeah, and part of what's going on is those rectifier tubes that were working on the flyback transformers to give you the approximately 30,000 volts, 35,000 volts to run the tube, cathode ray tube, it is capable of X-rays because the rectifying tube was seeing peak inverse voltages that were some really fierce numbers. The X-rays start becoming harder and harder. Hard X-ray means it's got more penetrating capability as you raise the voltage of the circuit that's generating the X-rays. And you were walking a very narrow fence, so to speak, when you designed a color television set. You wanted the voltage to be as high as possible to give an intense picture with good focusing. But the federal laws or the state laws, I guess it was federal laws, were restricting how high a voltage you could use because of the hardness of the X-rays that would be generated as a byproduct of the whole process. Okay, we're going to give a little bit of delay, and then Alex is going to pick up into a NNU. I knew he'd have a comment. Those guys in Yonkers, they're not that quiet. They're not quite that quiet. So with some delay, Alex, you pick up KQRIW in the TechNet. Dick? Who said Dick?
K2J, I just want to mention one other thing.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, by the way, your high voltage numbers are a little high. Most modern color TVs, they're kind of restricted to around 27,000 volts. It's projectors that have 32 and 33. But before they stopped making tubes, they were making 50 and 52 inch tubes. The high voltage was still about the same. The amount of current was just a couple microamps more, but where all the juice was, because they were 110 degrees next on them, all the energy was in the yoke as far as bending the beam goes.
Okay. So I think you're saying the laws restricted you to 27,500 or some number like that, but if you really want full performance out of the tube, it would be sure nice to be allowed to use 30,000 to use the acceleration to the faceplate. Is that approximately right, Eric?
2KY, we're coming.
Eric, first, and then Mel. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, even the big ones, there was no reason to go to a higher voltage because the minimum spot size that you can get out of the beam is, you know, the size of the dot on the screen. So there's no point in making it any finer. But the energy that required to do that large scan with the short mechs was, you know, you'd have these huge amplifiers that were connected to the yoke to make the magnetic field required.
Now, as a person who has worked in broadcast, and therefore you at least heard the sounds of misery of people who had to do a color television tube alignment, when it comes to a really large cathode ray tube with 110 degree of deflection, and you want linearity and accuracy of all three of those beams, the red, green, and blue, or the equivalent of however they're made with a Lorentz tube, to get proper alignment of that tube, that alignment procedure with the fancy signal generators required, my guess is that was a real art form, and even if you got that critical alignment where you got top-notch performance, I think a person might decide to move the furniture in the room, and the set that used to aim to the north now aims to the east, and the Earth's local magnetic field or the magnetic objects in the room can disturb some of that careful alignment. So the tune-up of that tube to give you top performance was difficult and an art form, is my guess. I wonder if you agree or disagree with that, Eric. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
Forgot about Yonkers.
Well, let me tell you this much, Dick. Came the end of tube manufacturing, those problems pretty much no longer existed. The difficulty in doing conversions was a matter of how cheap the manufacturer wanted to be. You know, you spend some more money, you use some more parabola and waveform generators, it gets easier. Don't forget Mel.
Okay. We've been holding out off Alex. Alex and Mel in that order. I hope I'm not getting Mel angry at me. Alex, tell us what the guys in Yonkers think about all this. N2NNU, K2LIW.
Can be Yonkers angry on you? Never. Well, CRTs are, let me put it backwards for you. The flat panel displays are much worse than the CRTs. They are not better. And the major problem with it is the pixel position uncertainty. The analog signal coming in might fall between the two pixels, and then the electronics has problems in positioning the pixel. This is why we see double up points. The only reason why the CRTs are on the market so prevalent now is because the manufacturers are pushing it. It is much cheaper to produce a flat panel display than a CRT. They can be stamped out. No human intervention, no alignment, no nothing. Bang, bang, bang. In the time that you make one CRT monitor, you make 100 of the other ones. And this is basically why the flat panel displays are so prevalent. If it would be for technical advance, we would have today cars running at 200 miles per gallon. But that's nothing that is interest of the manufacturers of gas. The same principle is here. They want us to get eye crossed just looking to that flat panel, because that's easier for them. It's simple like that. I will not put on my desk flat panel or anything. My main workstation is a 43-inch Sony, and that works just fine. It doesn't matter. It's big and thick and whatever. It works fine. Back to you, Dick.
I can tell that Alex is a CRT man from way back, and he's going to be one for some time to come. And I was one until my CRT monitor for my computer failed, and I had to go over to a flat screen. And the flat screen, once you get used to it, is okay. Not quite as nice. There was another comment I was going to make about the flat screen. All of a sudden, the cold cathode fluorescent tube that's behind the flat screen is what's providing the illumination.
LEDs today.
And they're about to become LEDs, you're absolutely right. And these super efficient LEDs with whatever color you want, and whatever whiteness level and efficiency and so on, and they're going to be becoming a hell of a lot more prevalent when it comes to the laptop computers. So cold cathode fluorescent tubes and their disadvantages are slowly going to become a thing of the past. And light emitting diodes, even the compact fluorescent tubes that we use in our homes, an awful lot of those are going to become light emitting diodes. And Glenn from KC2QIQ has been telling us about that. So that's a new technology coming over the horizon. But for the guys on Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn, I bet you you're using a cathode ray tube on your computer, Mel, that's my guess. But you've been exposed to these flat screens, and I bet you you got some opinions on all that. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Yes, I'm using cathode ray. In fact, I picked up some nice monitors that people chucked out. Some of them had literally nothing wrong with them, and just because they wanted to put in this new Fandango thing. Now, as far as color TV years ago, I changed a lot of picture tubes in my time. The worst offender in the old original television was that the rectifier they used was a 383. And then they had the high voltage regulator tube, which just actually took the rectified voltage off the 383, and then they put it into this catheter tube called the 60K4. And that that was a real X-ray piece of tubing that they stuck in there. And they had to discontinue that tube, and they replaced it with a 6EL4. That was wrong with an internal lead shield. You know, you just felt the weight of that tube. You know, you didn't expect the tube to be that heavy in that size tube, a vacuum tube. So anyhow, but the convergence, yeah, it was a pain in, you know, what some of them panels, they had a lot of interaction. Some of the tubes, you couldn't really converge, you change a picture tube, and you had to change it again because they rebuilt it and they did a crummy job or something because you couldn't get it to converge properly. So I went through all that stuff. And you mentioned about, you know, CRTs. Well, I'm going to stick with my CRT scope. I like, I'm using my Tektronix scopes and all with CRTs, and I'm very happy with them. And so that's the way I feel right now about CRTs, Dick. As far as, oh boy, here comes the rains again. Are you getting a thunderstorm out where you are, Dick? Over.
Check in.
Check in. We're going to pick you up in a second. No, the thunderstorm hasn't gotten to me yet, but I can hear by the static crashes I'm hearing through the repeater. It's obviously at the repeater site. And what's the thunder like for a guy who lives one block off of the water on Dover Street in Brooklyn? Over to you, Mel.
Flashing away over there at the ocean. That, oh boy, look at that one. That was a big discharge I saw. Most I heard it on the repeater. Yep. So anyway, that's the story with, and I'll tell you, you mentioned implosion. Well, I could tell you about one. When a guy put a bullet through the front of a face. Wow, listen to that rain. Wow. My hailing. There's ice coming down, Dick.
Dick? Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
All right. You know, the reason why people like CRTs, for example, I have a 36-inch, 16x9 set here. By the way, converging it is a snack. It's a broadcast monitor, so it's got 3 rows of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 knobs. So it's got 6 rows of 6 knobs. It's 3 rows of horizontal, 3 rows of vertical. But it also has a computer which you can actually fine-tune every square inch of the tube and never, ever be even slightly out of conversion, which is cool. But the real difference, let me let it drop. There's two factors that make the CRT look so much nicer. First of all, there's two kinds of ways of making color. One is added, and one is subtracted. Okay, in television we use an additive method. Now, with liquid crystal, you have a light source that it should be multispectral, and in the process of the light passing through the liquid crystal panel, it also passes through a filter, which is a set of dye couplers in gel that's actually printed that fits behind on the backside of the liquid crystal screen. And the phosphors in that CRT are being excited, so they're generating light as opposed to the liquid crystal, which is attenuating light. And the phosphors can be formulated so that the spectrum they produce is really consistent with what the eyeball sees, which is much easier to do than to make a subtractive additive filter that light has to pass through. So there's a major difference, and that's why the new displays you probably see by the summer actually have the same phosphor, the same ability to generate light per point, per pixel, as opposed to filtering light. Kick your RWK to Jack.
Thank you, Eric. So we're learning more about how these systems work, the additive and subtractive color system. I guess a 35mm slide is the subtractive type. The cathode ray tube phosphors are the additive type. And the additive type has been around longer when it comes to color purity. So I think they've done a better job. I'd like to believe the flat screens are going to continue to improve, particularly those new technologies. The person who said check-in, who was that? And tell us your call letters, your name, and give us a yes or no as to whether you have a question or a comment, and we'll come around to you. Check-in person, go right ahead.
Yeah, actually, I'm rechecking in because we were at some distance before. This is Tony, WSW. Actually, I do have a question. You thought I did it. We're right at the top of the Arizona Bridge right now, and I wonder if the lightning is modulating our transmission. Back to you, Dick.
When you talk and when Mel talks, yes, I do hear modulation. You're on top of the Verrazano Bridge right now. Maybe we would, while you're in good communication range, maybe we would hear a couple of words from you. We haven't finished yet with Steve, but Tony, tell us what you want to say while you're in good communication range. WW2W, K2RW in the second half.
Well, I guess I'm in good communication range because we have the height here right now. Is that what you want to know? I understand.
Give us your question right now while we can hear you easily. Go right ahead, Tony.
Oh, that's a good point. Yes, I wanted to ask you about the left-hand rule. Why does it work that way and not the other? I know this is a big question on, you know, the formation of the universe, the divergence of you know, things going to the left and to the right, you know, mirrored molecules and all that sort of stuff. It's, to me, a very interesting topic that I wanted to ask is, with all these superconducting super colliders and, you know, those types of devices, have they found out any more information on this subject? Perhaps it has to do with the spin of certain particles or phase differences, you know, how everything is functioning. Maybe you could elaborate on that. Back to you, KCYW, whiskey to whiskey.
Wow. Hey, Tony. You've asked one of the fairly deep mysteries of the universe as far as what I read in Scientific American. I'm rather light on knowledge on this one. The best guess I think what I've gathered by the articles I've read on the subject is that at the instant of the Big Bang, of this particular recreation of this universe we know about, there was a certain distribution of matter. We can talk about the dark energy, dark matter, and the visible stuff. And for some crazy reason, left was emphasized. We're talking about chirality here. In other words, things with left-handed or left-handed circular polarization were favored over the other one. I don't know why. When it comes to circular polarization of radio signals, that is a subject that, boy, you can have a grand old time with it. If you want to study something that is highly misunderstood, among antenna engineers with 20 years of experience, a significant percentage of them have a very uncomfortable feeling for what is circular polarization. Right-hand rule, left-hand rule, circular polarization. And the broadcasters have periodically thought that if they transmitted a circular polarized signal from the broadcast center, that some of the ghosting you get in metropolitan areas like the marble canyons of New York City, that some of that ghosting would disappear, and horizontal and vertical components would be there simultaneously, and the signal would have a zillion different ways to get through. On paper, it sounds good. You run the experiment, you say, what in the world's going on? Why did it work so bad? Why is it so poor? Circular polarization is very popular when it comes to direct broadcast satellites. Your KU band satellite, your odd and even channels of the transponders, odd and even transponders. You got 24 transponders or 32 transponders, and the odd ones are clockwise, and the even ones are counterclockwise. And it's a frequency reuse scheme, and for a extraterrestrial communication, satellite down to Earth, circular polarization works like a charm. You put circular polarization into a terrestrial communication where there is ground bounce, and all of a sudden you become unhappy.
Repeater, time out.
A clockwise wave after bouncing off the ground.
It is highly debatable, but I think it has something to do with. Let's see if we talk about it.
Okay, when it comes to broadcast, and when it comes to circular polarization in a terrestrial environment, Alex, this is the way I see it. You've always got a direct wave and you've got an indirect wave. You've got the wave that bounces off the ground, you've got the wave that goes straight. And I know I've branched off of Tony's question, which is really a biology question. And Tony, from me, you're not going to get a good answer tonight. I'm going to admit that. And I've decided to branch over into circular polarization, RF, which is a little bit different. I know that. But the direct wave, if I launch a clockwise wave, and some of it bounces off the ground and also gets to you, after the bounce on the ground, the clockwise wave that I transmitted becomes primarily counterclockwise. So now your poor receiving antenna a few miles away is seeing a direct signal that is clockwise, as originally transmitted, the indirect signal bounced off the ground that is counterclockwise. You mix the two together. If they were equal in amplitude, as in many cases they are, a clockwise plus counterclockwise becomes linear. So you launched a circular polarized signal, and you thought you're going to get all kinds of benefits from it, and what arrives at the receiving site is primarily linear. That's not what you intended. And the method you might go through to try to correct what happens is, depending on the phasing of the direct signal and indirect signal, that linear that you result with can be horizontal, vertical, slant 45 right, slant 45 left. If you're trying to get it into a horizontally polarized antenna, and the combination of those two direct indirect signals ended up vertical, all of a sudden you're in a null. And the whole reason you went to circular polarization is to get rid of nulls, and all of a sudden you're creating them. So in the broadcast world of terrestrial communication, circular polarization doesn't work anywhere near the way everyone thought it would. I think you want to make some comments on that, Alex. N2NNU, KQIYW.
Yeah. There is also a phenomenon when it comes to RF waves that I don't hear much speaking about it. It has to do with the ground wave, which is basically what broadcasters are deploying. It's called wave front tilt, meaning that if you take a cross-section through the vertical cross-section through the wave, you will observe that the closer you go to the Earth, the wave front will be actually delayed more and more and more. Upper strata of the wave will go faster than the lower strata of the wave. This is because, as naturally goes, the higher capacitance to the ground changes the electric structure of the medium. But that implies that any circular polarization will be distorted too. So my theory here that I worked out the maths and whatever is, as long you have proximity to a ground, you cannot have a pure circular polarization. That's my take. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, Dick. I'm going to agree with that. Go ahead, Eric. I'm going to make comments on it. Eric first. Go ahead.
You know, I remember reading somewhere when they started to experiment with the Ubiquiti, which is the HD radio. They actually did some experiments with something called elliptical polarization, where the vectors are out of phase with the plane. They played around with that a bit, and it almost became a standardized method of doing things, but I don't think it ever became the case. Any thoughts on that, Dick?
Okay, the word circular polarization is a relative word. Very, very few systems on planet Earth create pure circular polarization. There's always a slight ellipticity. That's called the axial ratio. In other words, to an antenna engineer, the method by which he measures the quality of circular polarization is to take a linear polarized receiving signal, slowly rotate it, and find out in what direction you get the strongest signal, in what direction you get the weakest signal, and what is the ratio between the two in decibels. The usual rule of thumb is that if your axial ratio is less than 1 dB, people will call it circular. It really is elliptical, where your major axis and your minor axis are 1 dB apart. And even if you're launching a beautiful, pure, circular polarized wave in terrestrial communication, if some of that wave has to go through a forest of trees, which are more vertical than horizontal, it's attenuating one of the components more than the other, and you're going to end up with elliptical. So elliptical is always there. When it comes to satellite communication, like AMSAT satellites, ham radio communication, CP on the ground to that extraterrestrial source works rather well, unless the satellite is on your horizon, and now some of that signal between you and the satellite is going through trees, bouncing off ground, and whatever. So, and as I was starting to say earlier, let me drop. Circular polarization among antenna engineers is something that's not easily understood. They have an awful lot of trouble with it. You take, for instance, Henry Jasek, the guy who is the editor of the very first Bible on the subject called the Jasek Antenna Engineering Handbook, McGraw-Hill, 1961, a classic book where he gathered all of the experts that seemed to exist at that time, and each one of those experts wrote a chapter of that 35-chapter book. I think it's around 35 chapters. 35 individual kinds of antenna types were being emphasized. So here's one of the giants of the antenna world, and I used to work with Henry and had some interesting conversations with him. But when he ran the JASSIC laboratory, he once accepted a significant contract from a military customer to build a clockwise antenna. He built the clockwise antenna by the IEEE standard. When the antenna arrived, the customer said, "You guys are terrible, you're crazy. You sent us a left-hand antenna, we asked for a right-hand." And that's because the IEEE, Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, has one definition of clockwise. Classic physics has the exact opposite definition. And we can get into some of the particulars on that. So there's a this problem. If you're working with circular polarization, make sure that you and the guy you're talking to are using the same set of standards as to what you define as clockwise, what you define as axial ratio, what you define as the position in free space for the major axis and the minor axis, if that's important to you. So CP has got some advantages. It's got some strong disadvantages. It's got one huge advantage when it comes to certain environments for RFID tag readers, but it's got some disadvantages. Anybody have any further questions or comments on circular polarization, which we got into that one left-handedly by Tony's question, which didn't get answered. I'm going to admit that. And if you think you've got a better answer for Tony, please let us know right now, because I'm floundering. K2LIW listening.
You do realize that all the DirecTV and EchoStar satellites are circularly polarized?
I sure do. KU-band direct broadcast satellite uses a frequency reuse scheme where the odd and even channels are clockwise and counterclockwise. And there it works very well because it's a antenna aimed up in the air where there is very little multipath. And so CP in space in that environment works like a charm. But for terrestrial communication over the horizon, it's got some serious problems. Over to you, Eric, for comment on that.
You know, circular polarization actually works pretty well as far as satellites go. Because, you know, stick point in the sky, looking at the only thing you got to disturb you with and water molecules is mess up your polarization. But as far as ground and reflection, going from ionosphere to back to the ground, it's a nice theory. But you wind up with twisted signals even when you're using linear antennas. So here you go. But for space from point to point, if you have two places that you can see each other, helical antennas do a really wonderful job.
I certainly agree with that. So for space, CP is great. And by the way, when you're watching your direct broadcast satellite KU-band signal, and you get an extremely heavy rain cloud walking near your neighborhood, and the picture freezes, and the picture drops out, good common sense would lead you to believe, okay, I'm getting attenuation from rain. At KU-band, rain does create attenuation. For the most part, that's not what's happening. Yes, if you're in Bangladesh and you get a monsoon rain, there the rain attenuation would be so severe that the signal is below threshold and the demodulator drops out. For the most part, when you and I see great big rain in the United States and the picture drops out, it is because of contamination. The raindrops, as they get very large, are no longer spherical. They're now taking on a so-called teardrop shape, and therefore the clockwise wave, which is the odd transponders, which overlap in frequency with the counterclockwise wave of the even transponders from that satellite, means that when those simultaneous signals hit those raindrops and they get mixed together in polarization, the purity of those two signals, where you want 35 dB or so of isolation between clockwise and counterclockwise, it degrades, and all of a sudden the poor demodulator, your satellite receiver, is trying to get transponder number two. It's getting a mixture of the upper portion of transponder one, the transponder 2, and the lower portion of transponder 3 all mixed together, and it says, "I give up, forget it." Let's freeze his picture and tell him to wait patiently until that dawn rain cloud gets out of the way. So it's the cross-polarization characteristics of non-spherical raindrops is one of the major reasons for dropout you'll see with your KU-band satellite. There are lots of people who said that, okay, it's attenuation, I'll compensate, I'll put up a larger dish so I got a bigger fade margin. It doesn't necessarily solve the problem. I wonder if some of the broadcasters used to think they could solve the problem that way. Although I guess an awful lot of the C-band is really linear. You might have some comments on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2IW, K2JAC. Well, all the stuff that the broadcasters and the cable folks use is all linear. The reason why it's linear, the reason why it's horizontal and vertical, because the small size of the wave, you can double the amount of work that you can do off of one satellite. So, I mean, it was really done for, to double the amount of space you can have. And it has its problems. That's why the networks, like my particular network, has two uplink facilities that's like 200 miles apart. And the theory is that if you got bad weather over one, you don't necessarily have bad weather over the other. And when you see trucks going out there and in bad weather, you don't get to see it because usually when the link is good, the link is good, and you know, you've got to do your 2-minute little piece, you get it out and it's done. But if you're actually sitting there in a control room watching, you see them coming in and out according to what the weather's doing. K2RW, K2J.
Interesting information. So for the people doing electronic news gathering and sending the signal back to their studio by way of a satellite, local weather conditions can certainly make their life a little bit more complicated. I think we jumped quite a bit away from the original question that Steve asked, and I hope he at least got part of his answer of cathode ray tubes versus flat screen displays. Let me pass it back to Steve to make sure we finished his before we go on to the next person. KC2MDP, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I'm still here, Dick. Yeah, very good. You answered pretty much. I sort of got an understanding of what's going on. I would imagine that the flat screens are probably going to get a lot better, and I would imagine that they'll also outlast as far as, hours, outlast the use of the old CRTs. And I would imagine they would be greener, too, where as far as forcing them away, we live in a throw it out and buy a new one world. I would imagine that they've got to be greener. Just your opinion on that, Dick, back to you.
Yeah, Eric sort of approached that one earlier. In order to protect you from X-rays, there's a whole lot of lead built into that glass on the front end of a cathode ray tube. And when you throw those out and they get crunched up into a dump site, that lead is coming back into the environment, and that's not good. The toxic materials that are in flat screens, I think, are much friendlier. Probably the most toxic thing there was the lead that was used for the old-fashioned soldering before RoHS came along. RoHS stands for Removal of Hazardous Substances. So they're trying to remove the lead from solder, and there's quite a bit of difficulty with that. My good buddy Kent, who lives in Grand Prairie, Texas, right outside of Fort Worth, had to do some plumbing repair at his house, and he had to make 5 serious attempts with non-lead bearing solder in order to get a good solder joint. So these solders that no longer contain lead are much more difficult to use, and they've got their problems. There are a significant number of smart people who are hoarding the old-fashioned lead tin solder so that on critical joints they can make them when they need to. There are certain military programs that are saying you will not use these non-leaded solders on our program because of the whiskers that form in the new kind of solder, which causes circuit failures. So nothing is easy. By the same token, when they removed Freon, Halon, the fire extinguishers that are built into anechoic chambers and built into aircraft for years and years contained Halon. Halon works like a charm when it comes to putting out fires. It does a beautiful job, reasonably compatible with human beings. And so, since it is a chlorofluorocarbon, which is eating up the ozone in the atmosphere, and we want to stop doing that, that's the reason why we've outlawed Freon 12 for the air conditioning of automobiles. We eliminated the halon, and therefore they've been looking for a substitute, and every substitute they found for fire extinguishers doesn't work anywhere near as well as halon did. So as we try to get greener, we sometimes pay a pretty heavy price. I think the next person with a question, if I got my list correctly, is Joe, W2RYY, and then we're going to repeat her.
Time out.
and then we'll go to other people. Joe, from E2RYY, go right ahead with your question. And have you been doing some more of those experiments as to how many of the high-def television channels can you receive in your neighborhood? You got it, Joe.
Well, no, I haven't. That wasn't my question. Let me turn the volume down so I can see back here. All right, there you go. I had a question. A while ago, I worked for a place that used microwave transceivers to go point to point to run T1 lines. And initially, they ran on 2.4 gig. And for some reason, we had an interference problem that had to get moved, had to move the stuff and go up to 5.8. The line going up the installation, up the tower, the pole, whatever, was LEF 5-50 cable, 7/8 cable, which was very good at 2.4 gig, no problem with the loss. When we had to move up to 5.8 gig, the guy told us who made the microwave transceivers, the company representative, that we had to change the cable to LDF 4-50. And it kind of goes against your theory of what you think, because you think, well, a smaller cable like that would have more loss at 5.8 gig than 7/8 does. But apparently he told me it's got something to do with causing reflections when you're using a digital signal being transmitted through the cable. The digital signal and the reflections it causes would mess up the digital signal. Have you ever heard of this type of phenomena?
Oh, absolutely. One of the first books you can get a hold of that will give you a little bit of a hint of what's going on is Microwave Transmission Techniques, I think it's called, by Marino. It's a 1950 paperback book, but a classic. As you move up in frequency, all coaxial cable will increase in loss, copper loss as well as dielectric loss. And as you make coaxial cables larger in diameter, as you go from 7/8 to 1-5/8 cable, as many of the 432 moon bounce guys do, the cable loss goes down. So going up in frequency, you get more loss, but going up in diameter, you get less loss. So like you were saying, when you move from 2 gigs to 5 gigs, you would think you'd want to increase the cable diameter. There's another problem. And that is, every coaxial cable has a frequency region above which it can act like a piece of waveguide. At first you'd say, hey, the signal's going down the cable. Who cares if it's going down there by the coaxial mode, where you've got a voltage difference between center conductor and outer conductor, or the waveguide mode, where it looks at that piece of coax cable as a hollow pipe, and it almost ignores the center conductor. At first you'd say, gee, the signal's going down the pipe, who cares? Uh-oh, you got a problem. If you compare the method of propagation, in the case of coaxial cable, TEM it's called, transverse electromagnetic, when you're really using the center conductor, the signal literally goes straight down the coax cable. When you use it in the waveguide mode, the signal is bouncing back and forth, zigzagging between the walls. The waveguide mode moves slower. Phase-wise, it moves faster. Group delay, it moves slower. So you got two different velocities of propagation and two different modes by which the signal can go down a large piece of cable. So Marino has got a nice formula telling you what is the lowest frequency at which your cable can support the undesired mode. It's called a TE11, transverse electromagnetic circular style subset, subscript 11. That's the waveguide mode, the first one, whereas the normal coax mode moves faster. So at the other end of the cable, when you've got high-speed digital, you've now got two individual pulse streams, one leading the other. And if you're unlucky...
Repeater, timeout.
And if you're unlucky where the lead and the lag between the two waves creates inter-symbol distortion, where you wanted the one to become a zero and the other one, the zero, became a one because of the phase lag, all of a sudden you get garbled. So every piece of coax cable has a frequency beyond which you would like to not use it under normal circumstances. Now, one of the things that I've been advocating for some time is that the really smart ham radio operators who realize that they don't need super bandwidth like broadcast does and like military channels do, where most of our ham bands are all related by an octave apart. You know, the 40-meter band is approximately twice the frequency of the 80-meter band. So all of our ham bands are essentially octave-related, but relatively narrow in percentage of bandwidth. if you're smart enough to set things up correctly, you can literally use the fact that the waveguide, that your coax cable will support a waveguide mode and adjust the lengths accordingly to compensate for it. Over narrowband, you can do that. And your overall insertion loss can go down because there's two ways the signal can get there, and if you're smart enough, you can make them run together to be co-phased with each other. High-speed data would give you a problem, but for most of the stuff we do, it can work. So that's what I think you were running into there, Joe. And as I said, Marino, I think there's a chapter also in the transmission line section of reference data for radio engineers. Just know that there's a set of formulas you can go to. The Microwave Experimenter's Handbook of ARRL will also show you that once you know the outer diameter, the inner diameter of the outer conductor of your coax cable, you can relatively easily calculate at what frequency does it begin having the waveguide mode, which as a ham, it shouldn't stop you. As a commercial user, it will, or a military user, it will stop you. But as a ham, if you're smart enough, you can use it to your advantage. You discover that you've got lemons by mistake, well, it's time to make lemonade, if you know what I mean. I know that's not a complete answer, but maybe it helps. To be A2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that's a pretty good answer. It's I don't think I was really that familiar with that, but that's a very good answer. I got some information on the TV antenna you were asking, but I just have, I'm doing something on my computer. I'll be back in about maybe 2 minutes. So why don't you take a pause here and see if somebody on the internet has any questions or anything else they want to pop in. I'll pop back in about 3-4 minutes, okay? How's that sound?
Sounds good to me. Tony, I think, had a question. And Tony, I didn't catch your whole call letters. If you're still there, give us your call letters and your question, Tony. K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. Okay, maybe Tony's not there anymore. Let's see. We had Steve. We picked him up. Joe, we picked him up. Alex said no, but then he gave us quite a bit of information. Let's see. Mel didn't say he had a question, and Paul didn't say he had a question. Have I skipped anybody who signed in who said they did have a question or a comment? Re-give me your call letters right now.
U2OSR.
Hey, Bob. Mr. Secretary, what would you like to say about all this? K2RYW in the TechNet.
The antenna we were talking about a couple of days ago, Dick, I just looked at it. The beamlet is 45 degrees.
Okay. And for the gain that... you thought that NEC 3.0 was claiming was possible would require the beamwidth to be 21 degrees horizontal and vertical as a necessary but not sufficient. That any antenna with greater beamwidth than 21 degrees could not have that gain, and you're saying the beamwidth was 45, so it is a strong indication that something is not quite correlating here. What Bob had done, a rather heroic work, is he's building a, is it a 6 or a 3? I'm not sure which. It's either a 3 or a 6 element Yagi. I believe it's for 2 meters. And these modeling programs, some of the good modeling programs will have a optimization technique. In other words, you say, this is a vague beginning of the antenna I'd like to build, but do a Monte Carlo or whatever modeling technique with this program, and you tell the program, please find me the maximum gain. Tune the first director between these extremes, the second director between these extremes of length and position, and the driven element between these lengths and positions and so on. You let the program try various combinations to see if it can find a higher gain. And so an antenna that should have had, I'm going to pick a number out of the 10 dB of gain, through that optimization program, found that the program was able to discover a technique of getting 18.75 dB over isotropic. And for an antenna with a 7-foot boom and a small number of elements to get that fierce amount of gain, in the communication I had with Bob earlier, I said, gee, I'm awfully skeptical here. I don't think so. So give us any other words. It's an interesting experiment, and you guys have been listening to me. Let me drop. You may know that I make rather light use of modeling. Among the antenna manufacturers today, the majority of them have a philosophy of life. before they design a new antenna to solve a customer's problem. They model it first, then build it, because their philosophy is, I can, within the computer modeling program, I can build a 100 antennas, where physically with real pieces of metal and solder on a bench, in a day I'm lucky if I can build one or two. So by way of the modeling, you can build a large number of variations of the antenna and find some kind of an optimum and save yourself a lot of work. For conventional antennas, most of the time this works. For the consulting work that I've been doing over the last few years, we're finding antenna designs that we're getting patents on, and we think we're making breakthroughs. I think we're inventing some new antennas. Some of those antennas do not give the right results with modeling, whereas real instrumentation in a real laboratory and a real transmitter and receiver says, wow, that antenna is a winner, and the modeling program says, nah, I don't think so. So I'm finding discrepancy between the currently available modeling programs, and one of the most respected modeling programs is called HFSS,